Welcome to Influential Visions. Here we interview futuristic leaders who share their deep industry knowledge and business experience with you, ensuring you have your finger on the pulse and your eyes wide open. Here is your host, Nathaniel Schooler.
I'd like to introduce Monique Morrow. Monique is a chief technology strategist, groundbreaking technologist, and a proven innovator. Monique is a former CTO at Cisco who has worked tirelessly to align technologies to society's needs. Monique is also the co-founder of the Humanized Internet. I've been thinking about AI for a few years, and like most people, I was initially worried, but I think now I'm actually more excited about the possibilities of working less hours, which is hopefully something that we should be able to do in the near future.
AI, as we know it, what we hear when we talk about the Industrial Revolution 4.0 or whatever you want to call it, is that anything that is repetitive, your robots will take your jobs over. So we'll take over the job. And so there is this negative narrative that comes out and says, for example, you're going to lose your jobs. But on the other hand, and so you see that and you say, well, there will be new skills that are required, et cetera. But that narrative can go further into information technologists, you know, people who work in IT, because technology is so fast. How fast are you thinking? How fast are we using our brain? Becomes a very, very interesting subject in itself. So AI for good, AI and ethics. I'm involved with the IEEE AI for Action group. I'm actually a co-chair of the Extended Reality Committee. We're looking at a narrative that discusses, it's very open to people, you know, whether you're a roboticist or a filmmaker or whatever it is you're doing, looking at how we use these technologies that covers a gamut of privacy, covers a gamut of policy to have a discussion in the industry about, that doesn't necessarily be, that is dystopian. AI could be used, you can have this tool that can be used to diagnose your own diseases. You can be, you yourself can become the center of that Copernican revolution, which is a good thing, which is a very positive thing. The other part of it is AI taking over jobs. I strongly believe that AI can be a stimulant, if you will, for job creation. For example, one of the narratives that we talk about in this book called The People-Centered Economy, Ecosystem of Work, which is published in November of this past year, is could we imagine something that's nascent that you can create with the use of artificial intelligence, a nascent job as a service for you. So with inputs that you would provide, you would say, look, I want to work in this geography. I want to earn this amount of money or whatever. And I want to work with these types of people. You could use this technology to create some feedback to you and say, hey, look, we have a job, the perfect job for you. And of course, it involves an ecosystem of players, which includes private industry. It includes government also, because they want to be part of this. And who do you disintermediate? And by the way, you could pay a tax for that, or you pay something for that service. And you could disintermediate, if you will, the unemployment office. Because if you can guarantee somebody that you're opting in for, I kind of look at it as LinkedIn on steroids, if you will, but it's reverse. It's very, very interactive. You know, you would be provided for the job that's tailored for you. It's called a tailored job as a service.
Right. So, sure. So what you're sort of saying is that this platform technology, AI powered technology, will slot in with people's personality traits, their current skills, their mindset, their motivations, the location they want to go to, and the amount of money they want to earn. And then it will, and their past career history and experience. And then it will go out and it will search for the jobs that would actually suit that individual and help them to upskill to get to that job. Is that what you're saying?
Nathaniel, it's in very much in that direction. And it's what information you choose to share, by the way. I think that's really important. I want to work with these types of people, et cetera, because, you know, there is this you know, the thing of it is what's very, very important is the privacy issues. You don't want something that's held by a centralized platform, right? I think what you provide can disappear, you know, when you think about that disappearance of data so that it's not just held by, you know, you should be able to get an instantaneous feedback and then you could see that the data is has disappeared or something to that effect. Because we have to honor the privacy you know, regulations, and plus we don't, we are looking at this platform, we call it Jobly, if you look at it, Jobly, doesn't hold data, and that's very, very important for you. Now, you make, the thesis here is that what you now have is something that is very interactive to you, which is very new. It's you can see where what is disintermediating at the end of the day. The government gets involved because now there could be, you know, maybe you pay, maybe that's a tax you pay for, right, as a service. We don't know. For example, in the Netherlands, you wouldn't be paying for that. It's part of what you, it's part of, you know, you wouldn't be paying for such a service. So it depends right on how, because I think this gets into regulatory tax policy. And I think there you have this gets into the sort of the ecosystem of players that we have to have in this realm. So that thesis about using Jobly to create something for you, nascent job as a service, is something I think should be possible. We believe it should be possible with technology, but there is also, and we also believe it shouldn't be a zero sum game. We believe that people, no matter your age, no matter who you are, when they opt in to participate in Jobly, should be able to have something that's a nascent job for them, and given the input that they have. So we think that that's important, and it's a possibility. I first talked about this at the Jobly at the Web Summit in Portugal this past November. In fact, it was interesting. I was on a summit. I was on a panel with people from the EU, from the Macron government, I mean, from various governments. And because the EU has, by the way, a big vote this year, I think people were very intrigued. Because this is a Copernican revolution. It is about putting people in the center and not having things happen to them, right? So that's AI job creation. AI for good is also, so we talked about IEEE and what the recommendations are in that area. But AI for good also has, you know, there's also the, what we hear often is the dystopian, this polarity between, gosh, weapons of mass empowerment. You know, I gave you an example of, you know, being able to diagnose your cancer, self-diagnose, et cetera. We're not far off.
If you think that the iWatch number 4 has already got an ECG machine on it, on your watch, I mean, that's...
Well, and here's the thing that becomes interesting. I would like to disintermediate the way healthcare is done. And, you know, you have the NHS in the UK. I mean, the thing of it is I was given sort of a hypothetical. Could we imagine paying for healthcare insurance $1 a month? What would that look like? Is it possible? Why can't we have a moonshot like that? I mean, you put people on the moon, you have a moonshot. And the reason that you have to think about moonshots in this space is where technology could play or not play is I believe we're still in the 19th century, especially when it comes to, you know, ageism. I think people, when Bismarck said, you know, von Bismarck, people should be retiring at age 65. I mean, people were barely living to 55. And so we have not come out of that. And we've come out with it with prejudices and discrimination. And even in the healthcare system, that is sort of gamified. I'm in it against you. And so I think that we need to think about, if we're using technology, the watch examples you gave. If I'm a good citizen and I'm sharing my data, selectively sharing my data with an insurance provider or whatever, I expect my policy to go down. I want my policy to go down. I just, I don't want this feedback to say, well, we're sorry, that's government regulated. Well, think about new paradigm shifts and in these discussions. So that's an example of, hey, we could be monitoring our healthcare. We could see whether or not we're you know, open for, this gets into genomics and to targeted smart medicine. We could actually see or experience whether or not we're going to be subjected to Parkinson's disease or dementia, Alzheimer's, and so on. We should be able to see that and not only see it, but do something about it. That's the power of targeted medicine. And so this is the power of technology at its best, especially when we're thinking about, artificial intelligence. Think about Watson's healthcare example by IBM. So yeah. we know that technology exists. We now, as citizens, have to become, you know, part of that central. We have to be central to that universe. The other component of it, however, is that we have to have a governance model, you know, because the then you have this polarity with, this is mass empowerment. I can take care of myself. I can look at, you know, how I can get a job as a service and all of this kind of wonderful stuff. But there is also the governance model is mass destruction. So, and that is, you know,
it's a paranoia.
You know, this gets into the singularity, you know, when robots take over, you know, when this gets into the sort of thing about robots having human mind, they have a mind of their own, et cetera. You know, the stuff that you see on film, or actually stuff that is occurring now, which is predicting for future times. This is more than the Minority Report. This is stuff that is happening now.
Oh, it's happening, but it's actually fantastic. I mean, if you can analyze someone's behavior patterns based upon a video mm-hmm. that's being played live, and then an operator can be alerted to that, yeah, in an airport, which prevents destruction.
Absolutely.
As well, yeah.
But then you have to look at the thing that becomes problematic here is who's watching whom. I mean, you get into sort of this
right.
Dialectic with, you know, surveillance society, et cetera, that we see in some countries. And I think that, I mean, for example, it is no surprise that China and the Russian Federation basically have gone out to say the country that controls artificial intelligence or has led an artificial intelligence will rule the world. And so, you know, you have to look at what that means, and that already is a statement at a state or a political level. So here you can get into, you know, surveillance. You can get into, and we don't have to look far back in history. I always give this example of abuse. We don't have to look far back in history when you had Nazi Germany and the SS working with what was part of IBM, the holograph populator to take a census, you know, the punch card. And they knew exactly where to pick up people based on their ethnicity, their religion, and so on. And this was technology, very targeted technology that was used. And so we have to, that's why I said we don't have to look far back in history, because it is looking at how governments, who's watching whom. So a governance model has to be kind of in place here. And when you democratize tools, which is very powerful, then we have to be careful of how citizens use these tools in a responsible way. For example, if I don't like you, is that spider in your shower a spider, or is it something? Is it a little very small drone with anthrax on it? You know, these are the types
right.
of things that now we can sit back and say, well, you know, that stuff of movies and stuff. But there are things that we have to pay attention to. And we have to, as technologists, and this is my point, you have to actually declare yeah. the intentional use of that technology from the very beginning. Just as you could say a pack of cigarettes
right.
can cause cancer, you can say this is the intentional use of technology. This is not to dissuade from research, no ways at all. But you have to say this is how we intentionally use it. We have to think about what are the relevant political systems? What should they look like? We could talk about regulatory tech and what is the background that we should have. For example, I was in Dubai with a group of 100, over 200 specialists in this area talking about artificial intelligence. And Dubai has an AI minister. So I think that's, you know, that's very, very key to thinking about what's the background that people should have, and what does it look like for government at a level of government. So, for example, when you elect an official, do you elect an official because they have an AI background or a cybersecurity background? You elect an official usually on the platform they're running for. You know, I want my education or something to that effect. But I think what we're going to see is that we're seeing more and more of the intersectionality between social science, political science, and computer science coming together as a discipline. And so you need to, because people as government, this is what we mean by regulatory tech. Government officials are going to need to have a background in this space, and they're going to need to have a platform on issues around AI and its use. Cybersecurity is huge. I just came out of a cybersecurity days in Switzerland, where I was a master of ceremonies, and I learned a lot. Governments are looking at, when your state attacked, you have minutes or seconds to respond. You don't know what the attribution of that attack is, and that's very, very disconcerting. That's looking at how do you get medium to small businesses to be secure. Do you have a certificate for security in this space to say you're always keeping yourself secure? And if you don't, you have to pay a fine. These are the types of things that we have to talk about in the society that we're evolving to. And related, machine learning and smart cities and Internet of Things and all of that, pinging of information, you have to have cybersecurity and cyber defenses a part of that discussion. So, for example, here's a narrative. You wake up one day, Nathaniel, and your mobile phone doesn't work. And the streetlights are going off and on. And you don't have any power. Your energy sources have been attacked. The trains aren't working. The subways aren't working. The tubes aren't working. The hospitals are in dire shape. Nobody can call anything. That's what an attack can look like, a massive attack. The stock exchange is just going wiggly. And who are you going to call? Because you can't call. And so, and what does defense look? So this is sort of the massive way it was looking, that it can look. And it's not to necessarily scare citizens, but it's for citizens to be very alert, about what are the policies that are going to be in place by governments, by the military. How are they training people just on basic hygienics of securing your platform and so on? So.
It reminds me of a trip I took to Belize.
Yeah.
I arrived in bank and then basically, bump into some Belizean. It's like, no, man, you can't get no money, but, the phone is off. This, and they were on strike for 3 weeks. I kid you not.
Wow.
So could not get any money for 3 weeks. Yep. Fortunately, we bumped into this lovely Christian lady and her daughter, and we jumped on a boat to Key Corcoran, which is a fantastic little island on the Caribbean. And she lent us the money, and then someone gave us cash back on a Visa card from a restaurant, right, to pay her back. And then we just hung out and relaxed. But it's like, that stuff can happen, but then it brings you back to what we really are, and that's humans.
We're human.
Yeah. And this is forgotten in today's society, I think, completely. I mean, you have people who just live for their Instagram likes. They live for the Facebook messages and everything else. And they don't know how to have a conversation face to face in the real world. And it is, we've lost touch with compassion and empathy in many ways. Yep. And it's because I think we can't deal with our feelings. So for an example, if you see someone on the street, a homeless person, and you temporarily homeless person, let's say, because they are all temporarily homeless, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, as much as they're in that situation at the time, they could be helped out. But you see them there. And a lot of the time you just ignore them because you can't deal with the feeling that it gives you. You don't want to cope with this dire kind of compassion and sympathy for someone that's kind of down on their luck. And it's really unfortunate, but that is just a byproduct of society in general and our lack of caring these days. I mean, the churches used to treat homeless people better 100 years ago than they do now. Yeah,
I totally agree.
As society, because churches have kind of retreated within their own environments because they don't want to upset anyone, and we're just obsessed with political correctness, as well, which helps.
I mean, when was doing the right thing a wrong thing? I mean, the point is the human has to, all of this, the human should be in the loop because they have to interpret the data that's presented. So if you're going to push a button, you better know what you're doing, right? And so something has to put, because it could be, I always talk about algorithmic decision-making and human rights as an example. We have lost empathy. Well, first, that's one thing. The loss of empathy is something that I noted as a loss. We talked about a trust loss, but I'm also looking at an empathy loss. And I think that's where we have to gravitate to. What is social good? What does good look like for humans? We have to have that empathy part of us. As far as education is concerned, we have become so dependent upon the tools that we have that there's a sticker that I have, Googling is not research. I remember talking to a chancellor of a university who said, I just want students to ask the question. If you cannot ask a question, if you cannot get into this discussion about right or wrong, and you're constantly having the phone at your hand, and that you're so dependent upon it, you're not able to think anymore. And that depth of thought and discussion is so lost upon us. And I will argue that we're coming back to fill that deficit, because that deficit of empathy, of listening, of posing questions, especially when we talk about ethics, we have to know, we have to understand. No surprise that philosophy is coming back in trend as a discipline. But we have to come back to, the humanity, what makes us human. And I think that's an important point that you have, articulated, Nathaniel, which I'm very, very, supportive of. At the end of the day, and the other part of this discussion is, if you have, going back to job and job creation, if robots are taking over your jobs, and you were talking about nascent job as a service, then the discussion is, should robots be taxed, right?
I mean, yes,
these are big discussions that are occurring, because after all, they took over your job, and people were thrown out of work, and you got to give people. I mean, you have to give people the chance to upskill. And the other point I want to make, going back to humanity, is humanity in the work environment itself. We have become so toxic. And this has, maybe it's tangentially related to technology, maybe it's not. But the whole idea of putting people off to work, I think we have to be very, very careful about. I think that you could do some creative things, like, for example, say, Nathaniel, we have a deal for you. We're going to give you a package. It's a different package on certain conditions. You're not going to get a bonus, but you go away for 2 years and you'll work. Maybe you'll teach in your village or your city, or maybe you do something that has a social good part of it, because we need teachers or whatever. But you still have the dignity of work. You still have a salary, and you're doing something good for society, right? And maybe after 2 years, we'll revisit whether or not you want to continue, or whether or not the group that you're working with wants you to go further. Right. I think we need to be creative about how we treat people as quote unquote resources in companies, and rather than just numbers and looking at what we're all called purposeful innovation, rather than just looking at pleasing the stock exchange or something. I think we have to be very, very careful for benefit companies versus, for revenue type of companies. I think I will argue that for benefit, you'll probably earn more. There's some arguments for that. And I think
if that dies through the use of AI and the reduction of jobs and companies making money without this social good element, right? Without having to contribute towards the society, and the people who cannot work because they've been disrupted or they don't want to work, right? The entire wheel of consumerization dies. So those companies, in essence, themselves die, yep. right? And he, you know, he's the first person to raise that with me. And I've been thinking about this for years, like since I sat around this round table with IBM back in 2015, with the editor of Wired and some really great people at IBM, you know, really high up people. And I was just kind of like, I was just sitting there and they were droning on and on and on, you know, like this chap from Wired. And I was just like, well, what you're saying really doesn't mean anything. Like, you're just speaking for the sake of speaking. And this is the whole problem that I've got with, firstly, Google, right? If you want to research something, you talk to people. You talk to people and you listen to content from people who've either done what you want to do, know more about it than you're ever going to know because they've got 50 years experience, yep. yeah, right? Instead of looking at some result that Google has adjusted based upon an algorithm that is, in essence, gained because SEO people are great at SEO. Yeah. And it's an algorithm. It doesn't give you high quality information. It gives you junk that is generally there for you to buy something, because otherwise, why would that piece of content be there in the first place?
That's true. Right. I mean, and I would go back even to, when founders of Google said, look, you know, do no evil. Well, do no evil is the Hippocratic Oath at the end of the day. I mean, it's really about that. I think we have had a strange dependency on these tools, and we're lacking the conversation, the agoras, going back and forth and having these conversations in depth. And yeah, I mean, the thing about loss of consumerism, the hypothetical that was put to us actually was a very strange one, and when we were all in Dubai, and that is, imagine 20 years from now that the world has 50% unemployment. What do you do? 50% unemployment. It was very interesting because the Chinese professor next to me said, well, that's a great thing. They don't have to work. The lady who is a nuclear physicist from Kinshasa said, well, that's a concern for us because if the developed world, and that was her view, you know, what constitutes developed and developing world is 50% unemployment, then we're going to have a terrible effect in Africa's 54 countries, right? And so she saw it as very dystopian. One lawyer fundamentally said, that will probably beg the policy towards assisted death, which is extremely dystopian. And the other one was more like, let's make sure we colonize Mars very quickly. And the person who was actually sharing that, his name is Callum Chase. Callum is an author of the book, The Economic Singularity. And basically what he was talking about is AI and the death of capitalism. So he had an assumption that economy as we know it, and the measures of economy, would be breaking. Would that mean if there was 50% unemployment that you'd have to reduce the cost of living? You'd have to reduce, you'd have to have sort of this different measure of economics. And so the economists in the room were very uncomfortable with that discussion. And so, but it's something that we need to think about, because the thesis here is that, you know, institutions as we know it are creaking and breaking. And yeah. And so we need moonshots. And I don't think, to your points that you've made earlier, we should be asking for those moonshots, right? You know, could we imagine zero unemployment? Could we imagine with these technologies? Could we imagine dignity of work with these technologies? Could we imagine not having a governance model around usage, responsible usage of these technologies? Who's watching whom, et cetera? And how do agreements? You're spot on about one thing. I don't imagine states coming to the table and saying we're going to, you know, like nuclear proliferation or reduction. We're going to use these technologies in a responsible way, because nobody will agree on what responsible way is.
Very much so. But also, let's step back a minute, right, before we move on, because I know I want to get to a couple of other topics.
Oh, yes, please. Yes.
We could do that in 10 minutes. We've got plenty of time. So what I was thinking was, what about the definition of work itself, right? And actually, because I was talking to someone. I had a thread on my Facebook the other day, and I you know, I was talking about unemployment and how, like, I think it's at an all-time low in the UK and blah 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 and everything else. But so what? There are still X amount of people who are not working. And he actually raised a good point. It's like, well, why do people have to work? And it's like, well, actually, you don't have to work, but you have to enjoy doing what you're doing. Yeah. If you can make money and you can still enjoy what you're doing, yeah, then the definition of the word work is completely wrong anyway, because actually it isn't work, it's enjoyment. And when you find that enjoyment in your life, yeah, you should get paid for it, right? I'm talking to you, yeah, and I'm building a few different things, and I'm getting paid for something that I love to do, right? I love to talk to people, I love to reach out to them on social media, and I love to use social media. So then it redefines, firstly, social media platforms. I mean, there's a new blockchain-powered social platform coming, which is going to give 50% of the revenue from ads to the people who are posting the ads. You're in full control of your data, so you don't have to share anything if you don't want to, right? And those sorts of things are going to destroy a lot of revenue that's going into Facebook and everything else. However, it still disturbs me that people could think, why do they have to work? And I think the word work is wrong.
Yeah, I think, no, I agree. So you've just burned another topic here. You should enjoy, first and foremost, you have to enjoy waking up in the morning and doing something that is of value to you, right? So what I'm talking, I think what we're all talking about is how we can bring all of this stuff that brings value to you and not you bringing value to something else, right? And you're there is some kind of compensation model. You wake up, you're excited, you're compensated for it, because we live in a society that says, you know, you do have to pay your rent and everything else, but you're compensated for it because you're doing what you're doing and you enjoy it. Now, it's a very interesting, you know, Nathaniel, what came out also in Dubai as a study on well-being and policy. You know, what they're finding out is people are burning out because of the toxic environment in so-called work structures. And so, you know, having policy and well-being, having policies that set about well-being is very important, because and that gets to the point of, I want to wake up in the morning, I'm excited about this, I'm not nervous about, you know, am I on the layoff list or whatever list, I'm excited, I'm enjoying the people I'm working with, or I'm doing what I love. And I think we need to, I absolutely agree with you, we have to bring that back and back into the definition of quote unquote work, where it's you, values brought to you, because of what you're bringing, you know, counter value to society, but also that you're compensated for it and you enjoy it.
Right.
There should be sort of the enjoyment aspect of what it is we do. That's why we get into the health issues, you know, burnout, overweight, stress, smoking, and you name it, diabetes, and all of that kind of stuff, because people are just so challenged. They're so insecure. And this is about bringing safety in your mindset, you know, because you don't have to worry about that anymore. There's removing that from the equation. Totally agree.
Yeah. There's also another fundamental problem that we've got with technology and with people. And it's actually overambition. Yeah. And overambition causes a lot of suicides. Yeah. You've got all sorts of different problems. We've got overambition, which is like, oh, yeah, I'm going to go and build the next PayPal or the next Cisco or whatever. It's like, look, you know, sort your brain out. The chances of you being able to do that, your chances are you're going to get run over by a bus 5 times or 20 times before you've even managed to build anything that's a tenth that size. That's the first ridiculous thought that we've got to get over. And there's nothing wrong with ambition. I'm really ambitious. Yeah, I am really ambitious, right? But I'm also enjoying the journey. And the problem is that people want to build a business and they want to build a career and they don't enjoy the journey. And that is creating massive issues. We've got technology that we were promised, right? Shorter working days, We were promised a better life and more money. Where the hell is it, right? Like, to do anything, right, you have to work 10 times harder than you've ever had to work in your life. You've got to manage your time really effectively, and you've got to be really good at what you do, or you haven't got a hope in hell of getting anywhere. It's just like, it's an insane world.
We need a new social contract. I mean, we seriously need a new social. You're spot on. There's no such thing as 35 day work days or whatever.
35 hour week.
Hour work. Yeah,
I love the French.
Yeah, but the thing of it is, it's not really working. And I think that's what you're seeing now in terms of it's a new social contract. All this technology, you would think, yes, people have this wrong assumption. I think it's an incorrect and inaccurate assumption that you're going to have a life of leisure, you're going to have all of this. But the fact of the matter is, we're still in these enterprises. I say enterprises in the old world.
Yeah.
And I think we need to, you know, wouldn't it be lovely to create a new kind of model? And I think that's the opportunity for us all. I also agree with you that this ambition, blinded ambition about, you know, I'm going to be a billionaire by the age of 30 is ridiculous, because with it goes, you know, I will squash you at any moment. You know, there's winners and losers, and my argument is, we don't have to speak in winners and losers language. The other thing is that the people talk about fail fast. Well, you know, fail fast is not forgiving for people who have experience, because they're judged harshly, and it probably gets us into the next model, and certainly not for women. And so I think that we need to think about fail fast can also be very, very disconcerting when you're talking about systems that need to, you know, that are critical infrastructure type systems. You don't want to just mess with that.
No.
So we need a new model, and the new model is this new social contract. It's a new social contract. It's like bring humanity back to technology. This is around bring humanity back to society in a way. This is about not haves and have. This shouldn't be about haves and have nots. Certainly should not be about winners and losers.
Yeah.
This, I will argue, we don't have to talk about a zero-sum game in this new social contract that we.
Oh, I agree. And also, if you look at population growth by 2050, the whole population of the world will have completely changed. I was looking at some stats the other day. I think you'll find that Africa is going to be number one.
Yes.
India is going to be number two. Mm-hmm. And China is going to be number three. So we're going to be subservient to these massive, massive economies, right?
That's true.
You know, everything's totally changing. It's totally changing. And I think it's actually quite exciting. The major issue I have is with these massive life coaches that say you need to step out of your comfort zone. It's like, well, actually, if stepping out of your comfort zone is your comfort zone, go ahead, step out of your comfort zone. But stop encouraging other people to be scared and stressed and everything else in their lives, because they don't need to do that to actually progress and do something they enjoy, right?
Yeah.
Like, I have major issues with that one.
Yeah. Well, I think stepping out of the comfort zone, it doesn't mean that you have to be scared about you can be comfortable about what it is you are doing insofar as that comfort is not reinforcing negative, what could be negative within the society itself. And I think it's more about, you know, being able to challenge yourself. And if you're challenged, what does a challenge yourself look like, right? What does it mean to kind of step over the cliff and say, okay, maybe I want to reinvent myself in a new way. Maybe I'm not comfortable with that. And sometimes those are the types of dialogues I myself have been involved in.
Right.
And so what happens is that people will sit there and say, well, you know, I don't know, I'm not getting this gets into mentorship and coaching overall. I mean, people think coaching is about finding your job. That's not true. It's about you reflecting. It's reflecting on yourself.
Yeah.
And I think we need to take some time to look at that and have those self-reflections about what do I need to do better that will be an improvement for me and value for me. I'm a person that believes that education is lifelong. I don't care. I'll probably be 99 years old if I live that long and just go on to the next year. I just believe it, you know.
That's so funny. Exactly. It's my mentality. Like my dad's 85, yeah. And he would love to meet you. He went to MIT. Yeah.
Lovely.
He went to MIT.
Yeah, there you go, MIT. MIT.
There we go. Yeah, he graduated in 1952 or something in MIT. And his dad went to MIT as well. And, you know, he is just like learning how to use his computer right now. And like, he's been listening to my podcast and he just gets it. Like, but it's having an open mind, isn't it? And just continual learning. And the funny thing is I was exactly going to finish this topic on that specific point.
I think that because we started out with IT and diversity, inclusion, and all of that, and then of course, well, let me just address that the one issue around inclusion, and then go into also into continuous learning. I think inclusion is a massively interesting discussion. I think that if we The way I like to put inclusion, Nathaniel, is the following. If our companies and if our organizations don't reflect the society that we have, then something is wrong. Right? They don't reflect your customers. If they don't look like you, I had people say, well, you know, I remember walking in when I was in private industry, walking into a meeting, and I was the last person, and the person who was a lead for the customer said, I was getting concerned because the people who were talking to me didn't look like me, right?
Wow.
And so you have to think for 1 minute, if you're building stuff, if you're looking, who's involved in those teams? How do they look? And I believe if we get this right, we don't need diversity officers or whatever, because it would be just so automatic in the way our DNA operates. And I think that, you know, we are diverse group of mindsets, a diverse group of people, whether by ethnicity, gender, et cetera. Now, in technology, unfortunately, we've been seeing a lot less in that field. In fact, if you look at, you can do the measures. If you can look at the top 50 or top companies that are actually led by female CEOs or people of color or whatever, you can see a massive decline. You can see some decline here, which is a concern. If you look at, you know, technologists and women in tech, I always say women in tech or people of color in tech or whatever, yeah, you can see some concerns that are kind of red flag. I think there's, it all starts, this is a complex topic, but it all starts at the home. And it starts at the home with who does the dishes, who brings out the rubbish, all of that. And I think that's the thing that we have to look at is how are we as families actually bringing up our children such that they have diverse mindsets, you know, that they're not relegated to duties that are typical for boys or typical for girls. I think that's a big topic area. And the very last thing is about education and training and so on. I strongly believe, I'm finishing my third master's degree now. I strongly believe that education and training and upskilling is not a responsibility of some company or some organization or some government. It's your responsibility.
Yeah.
It's really your responsibility. Yes, they can help with regard to funding, but in the end, it's your responsibility. And I believe that the thirst for knowledge should continue. I think we should always be posing questions. We should always be looking at how is this stuff affecting me. We should always be thinking about the what ifs. And it doesn't matter what your age is in that. Lifelong learning is something that I believe we should be striving for at all times.
Right, but I mean, with the gender gap, you know, the most important thing is equality, no doubt about it, right? But it's with a business, it's bigger than that, isn't it? I mean, if you sort of look at demographics and you say, well, okay, so who are we going to serve? Like, because every business serves someone. They serve a demographic. Yeah. So for an example, you might serve a really broad range of demographics, all the way from, you know, very, very young, all the way through to very old. Okay. So at that point, and also female, male, transgender, whatever, yeah, lesbian, gay, bisexual, whatever. It doesn't actually matter, right? But mm-hmm. the point is that you're serving individuals within those specific demographics, right? So that means that you have to have people that are on your team that are within those demographics. Otherwise, how do you know what you're doing, first of all, is working? How do you know what you're doing is right? How do you get your messaging right? How do you get your product right? How do you get your relationships working? Because if I'm completely different to someone, it's very difficult for me to have a conversation with them. Like I talk to just people who are lifelong learners. I don't really have conversations with people that aren't. Like, I talk to people who are enthusiastic and kind of not necessarily extrovert, but you know, they are outgoing in some respects. We all seem to fit a very similar mold of a person, of an individual that, you know, likes big picture thinking, doesn't really like the details. You know, these are the kinds of personality sort of, I would say, disorders that I have.
No. I think that, I mean, you brought it on, but because I think people have to look at, you know, we tend to hire, I think it's a thing, we tend to tap in people who think like us. And I think that is just around cognitive bias. And we have to be able, we're all infected. We have to be able to recognize it and respond to it. So, you know, that's a reality that we live with. We like that, you know, like minds. And that's also kind of a red light. We probably want to, you know, think about how do we get the big elephant in the room to ask the questions of maybe I'm not in agreement, but we need to challenge one another. It's not comfortable. And I think that being uncomfortable is something as organizations we should strive for. The other thing is, I believe in servant leadership. You know, servant leadership is lacking. I believe when I go through a door, I'll talk to the person who's collecting the rubbish, or the person who's serving the table. I believe in that because, you know, that's around servant leadership. It's not about who's at the board level or anything else. These are all human beings. And a servant leader is very, I'll tell you, there was a Harvard study, I think, maybe around 8, 9 years ago. And this question, this Harvard Business School, was a question I think was worth 98% of of your grade. And the professor asked the question, there's a person every day at 4:15 when you leave the class, something to this effect, there's a person sweeping the hallway. What's the name of that individual?
Wow.
If you cannot name that individual, I have failed you. You know? And that's the point, right? Yeah. When we talk about all of the sets of technology, but this is about servant leadership at the end of the day, which is what we need to bring something forward more and more in our organizations. That it doesn't matter. I'm not talking about a sweeping of holacracy, but I'm talking about, you know, the person who was serving you, but also you need to be serving that individual.
Right.
You know, you honor that individual by asking questions about, you know, how are they doing? I mean, what is their name? Where are they coming from? They have a story. We talked about homeless people, but, you know, this is about that.
Of course. Yeah. I share the opinion of your exact opinion on that one. I'll talk to pretty much anyone, you know, and I find it really important. It's so important. Yeah? Like, to the point the other day. Yeah. So where I go to church, right? I go to church every Sunday, and sometimes I'll go have a coffee with a few of the people afterwards. And there's like this kind of, there's this lady who's like, you know, caring the community. Yeah. She comes to church with like 3 teddy bears and puts them at the front next to her, or, you know, and then like, you know, she's kind of off the wall. I don't know what to talk to her about. But then there's like a lady that's a manager of the front desk in a travel lodge, you know, real kind of, you know, normal people, yeah, like people that are, you know, great people, yeah. And what I found really quite interesting is exactly what you're talking about. So there's an accountant who runs an accounting business, yeah, he owns an accountancy firm, yeah, and he's always giving out the service cards at the beginning. So I was kind of like, so I thought, I was invited by the lady who's the Travel Lodge receptionist. I really like her as a person. She's very clued up. She's really intelligent. She wants to do something different in her life. And she's open to learning. And it's just like, those are my people. People that just totally open mind. So I sat down with her. I sat down with this crazy woman who's got hairy legs and she's wearing shorts. Like, I hope she doesn't get a teddy bear. Wrong, yeah? And then another guy who's basically like, he's caring the community as well. Like, he's been in mental health 40 years, had electric shock treatment and everything.
Oh, my God.
So I sat down there with the, and then one guy who's kind of bordering on, he was homeless, but he's sort of bordering on, I think he's into drugs still and stuff, but he's quite a nice guy. And actually, if he got away from the people he's hanging out with, he'd be really successful. So I sat there and I looked at her and I looked at him. And then this accountant guy walked past me. Yeah. And he just, and I said, oh, hi, how are you doing? And one of the lady invited him to sit down and he just sort of looked at all of us like we were just trash. Yeah. Looked at me like I was a loser for sitting there talking to these people. And I was just like, I thought, do you know what? I don't want to talk to you anymore. Yeah, like, I have no time for people like that. If you can't be human and you can't, you know, talk to people and actually give a monkeys about them, then gender gap is an irrelevance completely because it's nothing to do with gender. It's to do with humanistic values of what sits behind people as an individual, whether you're male, female, transsexual, whatever. If you can't communicate with other people on their level, be genuinely interested in their lives, their opinions, and what their daily problems are in life, right? You know, it reminds me of NASA, okay? And that fantastic, if you heard, you've heard the story, haven't you? I think we talked about it the other day. And so someone walked past the cleaner and I think it was, I'm not sure if it was a male or female, I actually forget, but they walked past and said, so what do you do here? And this person said, well, I'm just putting a man on the moon, sir.
Aww.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's like, and that's the whole point.
Yep.
Your whatever nationality, color, gender, you need to be inside that business, completely attached to the mission of that business and the corporate social responsibility of yours and the business, because those now are becoming harmonized entirely from what I've been learning. So, you know, well, it's fascinating. Isn't that great?
It is. It's well said. Oh, wow. We could go on forever.
We've got to get to this next topic. I reckon we're ready now for IT and information management. What do you reckon? Over to you, really, because like I, you know, I've never worked in a big business. You've been chief tech officer at Cisco, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, tech is like ingrained in you. Yeah. Like me, I'm kind of, I only started learning about tech about 9 years ago when my friend Eric said to me, what are you doing, man? You need to learn how to use a computer properly, you know? And ever since then, I sort of sent him messages and I was like, so after about a week of me trying to use this computer, which now I would just go out the window and like drive over with a car, right? I said, so how do I do this? And he'd say, oh, this is what you do. And then like a week, you know, a day later, I'd send him a message. So how do I do that? And then he said, after the third message of me asking him, he said, Google is your friend.
Oh, no. Well, I mean, I always say I'm an accidental engineer and, you know, coming into this space, I think because of the curiosity of technology and how, you know, I got into, you know, chips and stuff like that in the late 80s, I think that, you know, tech, working for a tech company, because I've worked for a tech company, so that's your point, you know, to the point, you know, it brings in its different sets of dynamics. And they're the, you know, the thing that tech companies are very concerned about is how they're going. They do talk about, you know, zero-sum games, winning and losing and competing and being one or third or four, one, two, third, three in the marketplace. And, you know, what worries tech companies and what certainly has been an issue, what had been an issue when I was at Cisco, is the startup community. You know, who's going to eat your lunch very, very fast? So, and I love, now I'm in a startup community, you know, pretty much so. So I have a deep appreciation. And we have a very interesting inclusion, diversity mindset, et cetera. I think it's just so fun. But I think the thing of it is that it was always a dialectic between when do you eat your old to grow your young? You know, I mean, when do you cannibalize your services? You know, if it's still working, why should we worry? You know, when do we take new pivots in the industry, and what does that look like? And especially, you have to have people still maintaining the business. But the thing of it is as you're looking for new pivots, people think that's a cool factor, and they want to gravitate toward that, and they're not maintaining the business. And how do you reward those people who are still maintaining the business? And so, but certainly we worried about. And this is typical of very established companies, even the ones that we've been talking about, Google, Facebook. How do you maintain that leadership? I mean, so startups, they're constantly looking at startups. You know, where is that? Because why is that the case? They're agile. They're going faster. They could present a potential competition for you. And what happens typically? If there's a match, you typically acquire them, so you start eating them, right? And that, and you have to ask yourself, is that a good thing or what? Because there may be, you have to look at what is a cultural fit. You know, these are people or organizations that have been used to how they work with one another, and all of a sudden they have been sucked up by the Borg. And I have met quite a few people who said, you know, I can't wait to get out of this or whatever, being sucked up by the Borg. And so this goes into a very hard discussion, which is what does culture look like in these organizations? What should it look like in these organizations that are very big organizations, 20, 30, 70,000, I mean, 100,000 people, over 100,000 people if you're looking at IBM, what should that look like? And that is about, you know, you'll have pockets where people, what does feeling safe look like? How fast does fast look like? Could we imagine? What does imagination look like about what our future could be? And what are customers going to look like? I was always contrarian. I would always say our customers today may not be our customers, but tomorrow.
Right.
You know? And so it's all of these dynamics and factors, but is it fun? It can be very fun.
Right.
It can be very fun in that.
Sure. But maintaining your existing infrastructure, your mm-hmm. IT infrastructure, and the security of it, like that's the basic, right? Mm-hmm. And then integrating other, you know, products, for example, is kind of what you do as an innovator, as a board member. I mean, you have to move forwards, don't you? Otherwise, they're going to eat your lunch, because it's the natural evolution of business. I mean, it's been going on for hundreds of years. I mean, in the UK, you know, my mum's side of the family, they were in a brewery. So we had the eighth largest brewery in the UK back in like 1800 and something. But yeah. Back then, a brewery would start, it would grow, it would buy pubs, and then it would bake beer, and then it would grow, and then it would sell the business, or it would buy another beer brewery, and then it would mm-hmm. grow bigger. And that's generally kind of what's been happening in IT. But like, as far as information management is concerned, that is underpinned by the security of the business, right? And it should be, shouldn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I was going to say early in my career, I was involved in doing network management. And I think what's funny is network management has now become cybersecurity, if you think about it. You know, and nobody wanted to be involved in network. And network management was always the last thing people cared about in the days. But if you think about it, managing your infrastructure, managing the security of your infrastructure should be table stakes. Full stop. Should be table stakes, because so much is at risk. And by the way, when we're talking about cybersecurity, it shouldn't be, you know, just some group doing it in the company. It should be at the board level of responsibility. It has to be at the board level, because when something happens, when stuff hits the fan, as we say, right, in a nice way, we call that a very, very a big factor of loss of trust. And somebody will fall on the sword. And it's not that group in some parked in some organization in the company. It's going to be at the head of the company and the board members.
Right.
It has to start at the top.
Would you also say that to manage information, it's everybody's responsibility?
Absolutely. That was my next follow-up. Is that
everybody?
Cybersecurity, network management is everybody's responsibility. When I was at Cisco, we had a very interesting program where they kind of gamified it. It's like a jujitsu program, right? You know, and you would pass tests and you have a purple lanyard, you know, like black belt and all of that. And that is because the whole program was, it's everybody's responsibility in the company. Not just, you know, everybody has to be responsible. And whether you gamify it and create certifications around it, that's fine. But it is everybody's responsibility.
Right. So information management is basically everything to do with that business. Like, without information, a business isn't a business, is it? I mean, because it could be, that might be your entire business, information.
Well, then you get into something that's tendentially another topic, but it's data. At the end of the day, it's data. We're in a data economy. We've been in a data economy. We have to look at how we democratize data, where, you know, people are making money off of you and so on and so forth. So data is, it depends on how you categorize information at the end of the day, but data is very, very valuable. And so, do I have data about my competitors? Do I have data about future marketplaces? Do I have data, et cetera? How am I managing data of my ecosystem of suppliers? This gets into breaches and then loss of trust, et cetera. And then it gets into a subject of, can we imagine something where we're decentralized or hybrid decentralized moving forward in the future, rather than having everything centralized, that is data. So.
Yeah, and then how that data is stored, if it's encrypted, what containers it's in. You know, I mean, there's so much innovation going on in this arena. Like, you really need a team of people to actually keep up just with the innovations of what's going on in IT.
You do, and you also need to make sure that people, the consumer, is aware of. It's very interesting. Like, I think there was some study that came out that 6% of consumers feel that they're out of control, but 73 or 74% believe that they want to be in control. So, you know, of the data. They don't want to be notified. They don't want stuff happening to them. They don't want to be notified by some loyalty program or some credit program or whatever group that says, we're sorry, your data has been exposed, and call this number. They do not like that. And I think that we need to be looking at how we hold it responsible. But I think it's very important to put the consumer, the citizen, back in that center of that universe.
Oh, very much so. But also connecting banks to that. I mean, like, if your data, like, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to work out, that if, so say, let's just have an example. I just ordered my food. Thank God it arrived at 1:45 because you were coming on the hour. So I was just like, oh, my food's arrived, But so I ordered from Sainsbury's, So they've got my credit card details, right? Okay. So let's just have a scenario that a business has got details, someone's card details, their address and everything else, And that data is breached, Okay. The bank should be held responsible for ensuring that is not used, and it should immediately be notified automatically. It's a no-brainer.
No-brainer. I agree, Nathaniel. I mean, it's like, where does accountability lie? And sometimes you get the hot potato effect. Now, well, you didn't read the fine the fine line of your agreement, and so on and so forth. And so, no, I agree. I believe.
I'm excited. I think that we've got a lot of potential ideas. We've got a lot of opportunities. You know, if you think about all these amazing products that are being created, you know, as we speak, someone's probably got that idea of how that could actually work. They're probably already doing it. they might have done it already. You know?
If you want to look at, you know, ownership of your data and where that's going, I'm actually going to be in CERN on March 11th and 12th. March 12th is 30 years of the World Wide Web celebration.
Wow.
And Sir Tim Berners-Lee is going to be there. And he's certainly concerned about the misuse of this technology. And he's looking at, at MIT, he's looking at something called Project Solid, where in the end you become, the technology shouldn't be used for surveillance, but in the end you can become the purveyor and ownership of your data, right? And how you selectively you do that. And I think that is kind of the promise of what we can do. That is the promise, I think, looking forward, of how we become more responsible for our use rather than having dependency on central groups. But I do agree with you one thing with regard to banks and centralized institutions that have access to our data, whether they're phone companies or so on, they have to be held accountable.
Yeah.
And it could be something like, dear Monique Morrow, we're so sorry we lost your trust. We're going to give you a rebate or something to that effect. But right now, we still have arrogance of institutions that we have.
Oh, yeah. And that's going to be completely, they're going to be on their asses soon. Excuse my French.
But yeah, I agree.
They really are. And also, it goes to phone companies as well. I totally agree. I'm getting calls all the time from these numbers in London. Yeah. And I just keep blocking them because search and see if they've actually been, if they're a spam number and whatever. But they change the number and then call you with a different number, right?
Sure.
And I should be able to just do one click and it should be able to block that entire organization, yeah? All right? I should not even have to answer the phone. I shouldn't even have to do anything at all, yeah? And that should go for emails, someone putting me on a list, some email that I don't want, and it should just blacklist them immediately from sending me anything. But thankfully, I've got a really good web host who's a friend of mine, and he's been running a web host for 20 something years. He built me my computer. I just got a new computer.
Yeah.
Yes. 32 okay. gigabytes of RAM, and I'm just like, woohoo! but it's like you should be able to definitely be in control there. And
yeah.
But I can actually turn up my, so on emails, I can go into the server and I can actually turn up the severity of blocking emails. So it's like from 1 to 100,
yep.
I think. So I think I'm at like 9 now, yeah? And all I need to do is turn that up to like 80, and then very few emails will even come through to me. And I think I'm going to have to do that because I'm just getting a load of spam recently. And it's So, but also I can block specific countries from emailing me as well. Yep. And I love that feature. That's just, it's just amazing to be able to do that.
No, that's really cool. I mean, we need more of that because we have email leakage. We have, and there are security implications to that. I totally agree.
Yeah. Well, my brother, he's been working for Cisco for years and he's kind of educated me a lot around security, but I can't thank you enough for your time.
Nathaniel, it's been cool.
Yeah, really cool.
I've enjoyed the conversation, and congratulations on what you're doing with podcasting and getting the information out there. I think it's so important to have the narratives out there. This has been a wonderful discussion, and we could have even a follow-up on several topics. So
fantastic.
Looking very forward.
I'd like that very much. Thanks for listening. Please make sure you share this episode with your friends and business connections too. And don't forget to drop us a review wherever you listen. Thank you.
Thanks very much for listening to Influential Visions. Please make sure you share this episode with your friends and business connections.